this is something that we've been waiting for. We have got confirmation. The Mueller report has been delivered to the Attorney General as of 5 o'clock today.
I think the market's ready for a little bit of consolidation right here. It was a big move in a very short period of time. It bodes well for the rest of the year for sure, but there's a lack of a catalyst right now. And I think the biggest catalyst that we have going for us is Q1 earnings, which we won't get until April.
Well, I still think the Fed's going to tighten later in the year. I think we're in a period, I think it was exceedingly well timed that the Fed kind of basically took 3 to 6 months off.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Well, the Fed met this week, and what a surprise for the markets. They're not only going on pause, they're going on hiatus for the rest of the year, and QT will end much earlier than expected. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in Hour 1, we'll be speaking with John Kosar. He's still a little bit cautious, but he says he is seeing some support for higher prices. You're going to want to hear what he has to say about that. Also joining us from Moody Analytics will be Ryan Sweet. He does see a growth slowdown, which is probably one reason why you saw the Fed do what it did this week. But still, for at least 2019, Moody's sees no recession. And of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And coming up in Hour 2, The Big Picture, Jim Poplava and I discuss Fed Chairman Powell's press conference following this week's FOMC meeting. That's where he made a major pivot. We also discuss the possibility of a rate cut by the end of the year, as well as the scaling back and ending of quantitative tightening. We also talk about the slowdown in the U.S. economy, liquidity, and debt. And in the second half of The Big Picture, we'll look at the mixed signals coming from the stock and bond market. That's all coming up in Hour 2, The Big Picture. And now we welcome back to the studio Ryan Poplava for a look at what moved the markets this week. Ryan, we've had a lot of interesting news. What's going on?
Chris, let's review. A lot of mixed signals this week, both from company earnings as well as some of the economic indicators. A signal that wasn't mixed was the projection by the Fed for 2019, 20, and 21, where they think rates will be. And pretty much that's we're done. Patient was the term Fed Chair Jerome Powell gave back on January 4th to describe the Fed's stance toward the next hike. And it certainly had some mystery attached to it. Basically, how long is patient? Is it holding out for one more quarter or two or even three? It's clear that the Fed agrees with the Fed futures market, and patient means a total halt for 2019. Now, the other major addition was the announcement a decision had been made to taper their balance sheet reduction process starting in May and terminating in September. That is, they'll be allowing bond maturities roll off to the tune of $50 billion every month. That's where they've been. That number is going to slowly drop. Now, that number will start falling all the way in May and go to zero in September. So I'll let Jim get into the weeds on this Fed meeting, but this much I can tell you, the dollar got crushed and financials got crushed. The yield curve went into further inversion. In fact, I was talking about this with Chris this morning on Friday. We were looking at the 3-year and the 10-year inverting. So the 3 going at a higher yield than the 10-year. And that just shows that we continue to see very strong feelings on the global economy. And beyond the further inversion of the yield curve, the market actually rallied strongly, kind of emboldened by the dovish news Wednesday and Thursday. The other side of that coin is that a dovish slant for the Fed adds credence to possibly, maybe there's something to this whole slower global economic story. So let's talk about the signals this week that were mixed for both earnings and economics. So in earnings this week, FedEx had disappointed results and downgraded their outlook for this year, calling attention to slower international economic conditions and weaker global trade growth. Now, those results hit the transport index pretty hard this Wednesday. Other companies that factored into growth concerns were BMW, who disappointed on the year's guidance. And then there were some comments from UBS. The first quarter, they said, was the worst in recent years. Nike, while they beat expectations on earnings, said growth in the U.S. was soft. And just so you know, Chris, as we're going through this period now for the next few weeks, we know that companies go into blackout periods on their stock buyback purchases. So they go on these little blackouts. They can't do anything ahead of their earnings results, not till finally after those results come. So we see maybe liquidity in the stock market kind of dry up heading into the earnings season. And that doesn't add a lot of the cushion for volatility. So we do expect to see some volatility here as we head into the earnings season in April. Now let's talk about the flip side with semiconductors. AMD got a huge lift on news that their graphics cards will be utilized in Google's new cloud-based gaming system at a gaming conference in San Francisco this week. And that helped lift other semiconductors with it. Though that wasn't earnings news, it was kind of a prequel of what happened in Micron's earnings. Micron's earnings Thursday, pigging back on those bullish comments and view on the chip industry in general as a leading kind of economic indicator or leading sector, a leading industry, with their beat as well. Micron beat on earnings, but they did disappoint on Q3 guidance. However, the big issue is that in the conference call, the company made several comments about the industry's most likely or possibly near or already in a bottom, which led to a humongous rally in tech on Thursday, as well as specifically in the semiconductor index. So just a huge move there. And of course, we got an upgrade for Apple to boot to a strong buy. So the tech was flying on Thursday. Okay, so some mixed signals in earnings. In economics news this week, we noticed that jobless claims have since February been tracking down, suggesting February's weakness was temporary. Now, the Philadelphia Fed survey jumped nicely for March to 13.7 from the only negative reading so far in the index in February since May of 2016. So a big reversal there. And finally, to end things in favor of the bull camp this week, the conference board's leading indicator rose 0.2% in February due to the stock market and one of its components, the credit index, adding a large contribution. Now, the initial claims component, here's where we go on the flip side here on economics. The initial claims component was very negative in February, corresponding with the earlier data I mentioned for jobless claims from the Employment and Training Administration. But as I said, March has taken a turn there. So overall, we've seen some positive signs in the initial claims component of that leading economic indicator from the conference board. Now, the flash purchasing managers index data for Europe, here's where things got sort of bearish in the market. They continued to look pretty bad and showed some deceleration in the U.S. So let's go into that. Germany's PMI fell to 44.7 from 47.6. Anything we see below 50 denotes that there's a contraction there. So their manufacturing is contracting. France also fell for the first time in a while, down to 49.8 on their PMI indicator. And so manufacturing is now stemming in France. Germany is key because they are a very key exporter. Guess who else reported dim results? South Korea, another major exporter, just reported that their exports have fallen 4.9% so far in March. Now, the U.S. numbers also showed things are slowing in March with a composite purchasing managers index down to 54.3 from 55.5 in February. So a point down there. So just when we know earnings are around the corner and there's maybe some hope that the quarter could end on a better note in manufacturing, they didn't. And so here we go. Friday, major drop in the market. The Dow was down 1.77%. The NASDAQ was down 2.5%, and the S&P 500 was down 1.9%. Not a great way to end this week, but as you know, following the charts, the markets have had a very nice rally over the past week, and a lot of that has been based off of technology doing well, the semiconductors, which are anticipatory and leading in their view, and that's kind of where we saw things go this week. But I think definitely tune into Jim. He will really dig into the weeds on the Fed. But again, mixed signals is what I can tell you is what we got this week. And of course, with the market up a whole lot, it was time to take a little profits, it looks like.
Do you ever feel like going back when nothing seemed to be a drag?
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider.
That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
I think the Dow still might have some struggles ahead. I would be looking at that 25,250 level. There's a, you know, that short-term bottom back there from March. And, you know, it's really interesting because I do follow these PMO signals on my daily charts, and the OEX and the NASDAQ 100 both got buy signals. And I thought for sure this week I would see the same at least out of the S&P 500. Still haven't. In fact, the PMO turned down below the signal line. And the Dow hasn't even come close to getting a buy signal. The margin is so wide, and it's still continuing lower right now. So like I said, I think a pullback is totally reasonable at this point to expect in pretty much all of the markets. But I thought that was very interesting that, you know, the S&P 500 and the Dow are both the laggards right now.
Everyone wants to retire well. That's not as easy as it sounds. You need to make the right investment choices, decide when to take Social Security, plan for taxes on your retirement income, and create a legacy for your family. To retire well, you need a roadmap to help you get there. Let Financial Sense Wealth Management help you navigate your way to retirement. We provide comprehensive, thoughtful, and personal retirement planning. Call Financial Sense Wealth Management now at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Start your journey to retiring well today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, as one commentator on Wall Street mentioned, the Fed is the gift that keeps on giving. As the Fed said this week, they are going to cut back on QT and no more rate hikes for the rest of the year. Joining us on the program from Asbury Research is John Kosar. John, let's begin with the markets. They seem to be liking what the Fed said on Wednesday. What's your take here as we begin to approach levels last seen last fall?
It's really an interesting time and place, particularly for the S&P 500. We've been looking at the 2800 to 2817 area in the S&P 500. Really, we started kind of tracking it back in the fourth quarter. It was important back then. I knew it would be just as important on the way back up. So I'm actually looking at a chart now as I'm talking to you. And we first ran into that resistance about midway through February and really negotiated it for quite a while. And then I noticed towards the end of February that a lot of the market internals we follow on a daily basis to try to tell us kind of what's happening under the hood. We actually have six of those that we call the Asbury Six that we update every day for our subscribers so they can see that information too. But they started to deteriorate. And it wasn't more than 3 or 4 days after that that we fell hard down into support. You know, at that point, the support was the 200-day moving average, which at that time was about 2751. And then we had a lesser level down at 2739. You know, the market came right there, held, and then it was off to the races. And oddly, within 3 or 4 days, those our Asbury Six turned right back to positive. And these are not six of the same indicator. There's corporate bond spreads in there. There's ETF asset flows, the VIX. There's volume. There's breadth. There's a lot of a pretty diverse palette of various metrics in there. We did it on purpose to try to keep them from all flipping at the same time. But this time they did. They turned back to positive. And now you can see we've spent the last 5 days up above that 2800 to 2817 area. So there's still a few issues for the market that I'm watching carefully. But I'm impressed with the new buying pressure, particularly in the queues, particularly in the tech space over this past week. And at least for the time being, it looks like we're risk on again. And, we're looking at the old highs we made back in September as our next target.
John, when you take a look at this recovery after the December 24th low, it's almost been like a V-shaped recovery. As I recall, you would almost have to go back to 1987, 1990 to see anything that came out of this sharp. You may recall other instances. When you see a V-shaped recovery, as we did since the beginning of the year, what is that telling you?
Well, it's telling you that the market had a very violent change of mind right around Christmas time of last year. There's a reason for that. I would be surprised if we didn't talk about this the last time that you and I were together, middle of January-ish, as I recall, because this was kind of first and foremost on what we were looking at. There was a good handful of important indexes, industry groups that were all testing and started to break down through trend lines, uptrend lines that originated either in 2009. March 2009 was the low, the bottom in the S&P 500, or some of them started in 2011. But the point is, it was there in the NYSE Composite Index is one I recall. There was the Dow Transports, the Housing Index, HGX, I think is the ETF. But there's probably five or six of them. And the market came down into all these secular trends, initially broke them during the panic right around the holiday, and then came right out the other side real hard. And all those internals I told you about, our Asbury 6 pretty quickly flipped back to positive. And we have a model, correction protection model, that we also use kind of for a risk on and risk off kind of indication. And January 9th, I believe the CPM, correction protection model, flipped back to positive. And by the 10th, all of our Asbury 6 flipped back to positive. So the way that I reconcile that is there were secular trends being tested and were initially broken, but somehow that attracted a very aggressive wave of buying, and it pushed those assets right back through the line. And it didn't take more than a week until I saw the internals starting to perk up again. And that was really the beginning of this. So if you ask me what I think that was, I think that was a test of a secular uptrend that goes back a decade. And there was very aggressive buying that came in after it had been broken for a small amount. People saw value there. The market saw value there, and it turned it on a dime is what it did.
I want to turn to another index. We've got the Dow Industrials that look like they're heading towards their old highs. But let's talk about the transports. The transports aren't looking as good.
No, they're not. And actually, I'm moving to a chart. They're underperforming, but not by all that much as I'm kind of looking at this through broad strokes. Something about the transports that has popped out to me that is very interesting is, and I'm seeing a lot of this particular pattern. I don't think, let me disclaimer or preface this by saying chart patterns don't work as well as they did a decade ago. And I think the reason for a lot of that, conspiracy theorist that I am, is that there's a lot of algos out there that are thwarting these patterns and kind of using them to get investors temporarily off sides and then shove the market the other way. But what I see in the transports is something that I am seeing all over the financial sector. I can't even think of all the ones. There's got to be 15 different patterns. I follow a lot of ETFs that track 60 different overseas markets. We'll talk about those in a little bit if you like. I'm starting to see some strength overseas, which is very nice after being so weak for so long. But going back to the Dow, there's a chart pattern here. It's an inverse head and shoulders pattern. It's a lot of jargon that I hate jargon, but what this pattern basically tells you is the market was in a bearish trend in the fourth quarter of last year, starting to repair itself and starting to build a base. If we can get the Dow transports back above the 200-day moving average, which is not that far up above the market, and actually take those highs out that we made back in February, I have a major bottom here that would point to significantly higher prices in the transports here. It would well exceed the peak back in September. So even though it's been an underperformer, I do see a pattern that I'm seeing across the board in all types of assets, a lot of patterns like this overseas that are suggesting some kind of an intermediate term basis being formed here.
I want to go to two specific sectors within the S&P, and I want to talk about the utility ETF and then also the REIT ETF, which are breaking out to new highs. Normally, John, you would associate those two with, let's say, a more risk-off or a safety trade, but they're breaking out and seem to be leading.
Yeah, the utilities, that is true. And there's a lot of cross currents here. We're not out of the woods yet. I should probably say that. I mean, if I sound like I'm a cheerleader for the market, I am not. But we've cleared a few hurdles, and I see a lot of potential patterns being formed that could eventually develop into the next leg higher for the market. Going to XLU, you know, interest rates have really backed off. We've had a little bit of a pop here, here and there, but I mean, I'm looking at the yield of the 10 years, 2.52. Sometimes when the yield of the Treasury starts to get depressed, or is at a lower, it's been under pressure for a while, sometimes you'll see a little money going into utilities because investors, that are yield seeking are willing to take on a little more credit risk, for the better yield. So that could explain some of that. But I do agree, it's not thrilling, to see, the utilities making fresh highs if you like the market intermediate to long term. I think, the real estate situation might be the same too. I think the fact that interest rates have dropped 50 basis points since October, 10-year I'm talking about, I think that is certainly not explaining all of it, but it could explain part of it.
I want to talk about another anomaly. Normally, when you see the economy weakening, as we did in the fall, stocks are falling. We saw the yield on bonds start to drop. Eventually, that happened towards the end of November and December. So here we have the stock market in a V-shaped recovery, but we've also got bond yields dropping as they are on the day we're speaking.
Yeah, the correlation between the yield of the 10-year and the S&P 500 has not been significant or stable in some time. I mean, I try to look at it every few weeks or so just to see if there's anything there. But right now, that is not a stable relationship. That doesn't always work. Sometimes you can have both yields. Sometimes you can have yields going down and the stock market going up, and there's an argument for that too. I mean, if the Fed isn't expected to raise rates, it kind of gives a little backdraft to the market in some cases. So when I look at the relationship there, the first thing that I do is I go through our database and see if there's a statistical relationship going on right now over the past 6 months, 3 months, or 1 month. And if it's not, I try not to read too much into it. I mean, if you ask me what I think is going on now, I think, the market expects the Fed to stay on hold for some time, which is a favorable low interest rate environment for stocks to extend their gains, at least for the near term.
Speaking of bonds, John, we saw a couple things that were unusual in the bond market, including where we are today. When we got the downturn that came very sharply in February of last year, bonds did not rally in that downturn. And then when we got the market starting to roll over in October, initially bonds did not rally then. It was only towards, maybe in the middle of November and the end of the year that yields really started to come down. So it seems like some of these patterns that you're talking about aren't operating in the usual way that one would expect.
Well, when you're talking about the bond market, it trades different than the stock market. I just pulled up a chart here so I can kind of look at and address it. I've been tracking treasuries for a long time. I used to work in the pit at Chicago Board of Trade back in the day when there was open outcry. The way the bond market moves is it seems to kind of jump from level to level, and then it'll sit there for a while, and then it'll go right back down to the next level. Here's a good example here. Just very recently, we had a pretty fast move from 2018 up to 3%, and then we kind of languished there, May through August, September, and then we shot up to that 3.23, stayed there for about a week or or two. Actually, this is a weekly chart. So we kind of languished up there for a while, and then we collapsed right down to, you know, we're at about 250 now, and that's a support level. So I think some of the movement in the bond market, I don't know if you, I attribute a lot of that to the way the bond market trades. If we have charts here where we try to define, you know, the major levels in the yield of the 10-year, 260 to 249 is one, and we're testing it now. Prior to that, it was 3% to 314. So we got the 323 and we broke right straight down again. So I think a lot of that is just the nature of the way the bond market trades, is how I would answer that.
All right. I want to go next to commodities, and I want to talk specifically and begin with oil. Last year when you were on the program, and I think, John, I had you on in May, and you said you were seeing something that was kind of unusual. The price of oil was just jumping, and the commercials were heavily negative short. I mean, these guys were getting killed, and you'd only seen that happen a couple times. Well, I guess they came out okay if you take a look at what happened to oil after October. In January, when I had you on the program, we couldn't really see what was going on because of the government shutdown.
Yep.
What are you seeing with oil now?
No, that's a great question. And I was anxious to do that, too, because we were kind of flying in the dark with the COT data for a couple of months because of the shutdown. But through last week, the data, COT data, as I understand it and as I read it, pretty neutral territory for oil. And the other one that I look at is heating oil, because heating oil is positively correlated to crude oil for obvious reasons. And I look at it as a surrogate signal. If I can't see anything compelling in the crude oil data, I'll go to the heating oil data and see what I see. I see a very slight upward bias there. I see the large speculator contingent in heating oil appears to be bottoming. And that usually suggests that you've got some upward bias going on in oil. I actually just did a piece on oil for our subscribers 2 days ago, and I'm seeing a bottoming kind of pattern showing up in stuff like the CRB index, GSG, George Samuel George is a commodity index, iShares commodity index. Both of those are heavily weighted towards energy, which is, some people say that's a fault of these indexes as they're so heavily weighted towards energy. GSG is, I'm just looking at it now, according to our report, 62% of that is energy. So it's obviously got a heavy bias there. But my work suggests that those indexes look like they're going higher. And then I am looking at an ETF, which is USO, which is the United States Oil Fund ETF, which, if you can't trade futures, this is a way to participate. It actually tracks WTI crude oil. And my work shows that we've got the potential for an additional 14% move higher in there. The reason that's really interesting to me, and the reason I wrote the report yesterday, is because people are looking at that 2800 level in the S&P 500 saying, what do we do? Is this a peak? Is this a bottom? You know, do I buy here? You know, do I wait for a pullback? Nobody talks about it, which is shocking to me, because usually the people on financial television love to talk about this particular phenomenon. But the correlation between crude oil prices and the S&P 500 has been pretty tight and stable for the past 2 years. And you know this. Sometimes crude and the S&P will trade like each other for 2-3 years at a time, and then it'll go black, and they'll just kind of drift off and do their own thing, and then they'll come back. Well, they're in one of their comeback times. The Pearson coefficient for USO, which is the ETF I just mentioned, and the S&P 500 for the past 2 years, 0.84, past 6 months, 0.79, past 3 months, 0.96, which is effectively lockstep. So these correlations remain intact until they don't. But if you can go back a couple of years and see a tight and stable correlation there, I kind of like to make sure, if I am positive on the stock market, I've got a secondary correlation there that also supports that. And this, as long as this correlation stays in effect, and as long as the chart pattern that I see emerging here stays intact, this would also indirectly support higher stock prices because of the correlation the past 2 years.
And then finally, two other commodities I want to talk about. One is gold, which has been in an upswing since early last fall, and then finally copper.
Yeah, gold is one. I'm actually jumping to a chart here. Gold has been it's been a tough one. There was a clean downward breakout in gold back in tail end of last year. And then gold prices turned up to sort of negate that pattern. What I'm looking at for the near term is ever since we peaked, gold prices peaked here. This is a little more near term, but gold prices peaked on February 20th. I'm looking at GLD, which is the ETF I track for gold. And I like it because I'm a big follower of ETF asset flows. I think it's one of the only things that actually leads price, because money in pushes prices higher, the price of the asset higher, and money out usually sucks the asset down. The price of the asset falls when there's investment money leaving it. Those asset flows in gold have been negative ever since Feb 15th or so, and there's money continuing to go out of gold. Bigger picture, however, I think the fact that gold had a very bearish chart pattern, for the time being, near term, it looks like gold is going lower. But because there was a failed pattern, there was a huge secular chart pattern that gold prices broke down from in July of last year. Summer of last year. It went down into August, September-ish, and then it turned up. When those big patterns like that fail, most of the time, in my experience, I've been doing this almost 40 years, it suggests to me that there was a secular change of opinion, or there was a very significant change in the secular outlook for gold prices, is what I should say. And that would suggest to me that even though gold looks like it can drop lower here week to week because of the asset flows in GLD, I would not be a bit surprised to see gold exceed its 2016 high by the end of the year.
Wow. And finally, I want to talk about copper. Everybody talks about Dr. Copper. It's an indication of what the economy's doing. But another thing that really strikes me, John, fundamentally, if we're all going to go to electric cars in the next 10 years, the more electric cars that are out there, the more copper that's going to be used. People forget what goes into electric car, and a lot of it is minerals like copper.
Yeah, the copper chart looks somewhat like the chart of gold. They're typically not correlated. Over the years, they have been positively correlated. I don't believe that they are now. I'm looking at copper futures weekly right now, and it looks like it's trying to turn higher. It just got up above its 52-week moving average here within the past 3 or 4 weeks. I think the big level to watch in copper is 308, 325-ish. There's a big overhead resistance level there that we've been really languishing underneath since 2015. If we can get, so that's basically $3.08 a pound to $3.25 a pound in copper is what those prices mean, what those numbers mean. But above 325, if we can get there and stay there, I think we could have a bull market in copper. And to me, I can't trade on this information, but if we're getting a rise in copper prices, that suggests to me a global recovery in the economy, or part of one anyways. I mean, I think it's a good sign. I think it's still a good sign for the economy. And I had mentioned earlier, there's at least a half a dozen, maybe closer to 10 overseas markets that I have been watching, stock markets that have been underperforming and just getting smoked compared to the U.S. for quite some time. I'll rattle off a few of these as I'm going to my website. Some of the markets I'm looking at: Sweden, Belgium, Germany, EEM, which is the emerging markets ETF. China actually led the way. Everyone's talking China, 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 with the tariffs and all this kind of stuff. But China, GXC, George X-Ray Charles, that actually led the way higher in terms of the 60 overseas markets that I track. China kind of led the way. And now I'm seeing, participation in Europe with France and Germany, Sweden. I think that's a good sign for us. I mean, part of the reason I think we fell so hard last year is because the rest of the world was below their 200-day moving averages, except us. And I think eventually, you know, the weight of a slowing economy in the rest of the world took us down or helped to take us down. But you know, to me, when I'm looking at S&P 2800, I know it's an inflection point. I'm trying to figure out which way. It makes me feel good, feel comfortable that we're not the Lone Ranger anymore. We're starting to get some better looking charts, better looking trends coming out of the rest of the world.
All right. Well, listen, John, if I was to summarize, it seems like your indicators are telling you that there's a possible breakout, or we could possibly head higher if everything fits into place.
That's the general bias. I think you still need to be careful here. We're in the 10th year of a bull market, and although the yield curve has steepened a little bit, just a little bit here over the past week or so, it's been, twos tens curve has been flattening for 18 months on an annual basis. So you still have to keep in mind that this is a very long the tooth bull, and the bond market's been nervous for 18 months. So no matter where you are, or what market you're in, there's always a couple of potholes in the road. So that's kind of how I'm looking at this. But if you ask me generally, the way things look, I'm seeing a little strength coming out of the commodity space. I'm seeing, you know, global equities, specifically Europe and Asia, which are the ones correlated to us the most that I like to see do well. They are starting to do a little bit better and they show some promise. So generally speaking, as hard as it is to believe with what's going on in, you know, the world and geopolitics, I would have to favor the upside here with certain caveats to know where your support levels are and to keep an eye on your internals, because if the internals go bad, so does the market.
All right. Well, listen, John, as we close, tell our listeners how they can get in touch or follow your work.
The best way is to go to our website. It's asburyresearch.com and go to the contact tab. You'll enter your name and your email address, your phone number if you wish, and we will see that and we will send you what we normally do for your listeners is we set up a little spot on special for our website for listeners where we'll give you access to that. And we'll have several copies of our research we've done over the past couple of weeks so you can see what we do and other offers for you to learn more about us and to find out more about our services.
All right. Well, listen, John, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. Thank goodness the government shutdown ended and we can follow what's going on with the COT.
Always a pleasure, Jim. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
As we look at the trade discussions between the U.S. and China, we do expect some form of agreement to come to fruition by the end of the second quarter. I don't think that we're going to see a full rollback of all of the existing tariffs. We don't think that this will solve all of the problems or issues between the United States and China.
Well, the Fed met this week, and no surprise, they've gone from pause to maybe a hiatus for the rest of the year. What does that mean for the economy? What does it tell us? Joining us on the program from Moody's Analytics is Ryan Sweet. Ryan, in a recent piece on your site, it was called Sink or Swim, and you mentioned that 2019 is all but stalled out. Growth is barely tracking in positive territory. Consumers have paused their spending since Christmas. Retail sales have gone flat. Home sales and construction have been largely unchanged, and the global economy is struggling. Do you think this was what the Fed was looking at when on Wednesday they decided they're going to basically go on pause for the rest of the year?
Yeah, I do. I think they factored in, you know, many of those factors into, you know, their assessment of, you know, the state of the U.S. economy, where we're headed over the next, you know, several months. But I also think what's, you know, weighing on the Fed is the absence of any acceleration in inflation. So if you look at different measures of consumer prices, the CPI or the PCE deflator, they're all running a little bit below the Fed's 2% objective. I think, you know, what's weighing on them as well is the fact that long-term inflation expectations have been drifting lower, and there's concerns that they could be anchored below a optimal level. So I think the combination of, you know, this slowing in the U.S. economy, which has been, I think, more abrupt than, you know, what the Fed has anticipated and what many economists were expecting, in combination with some, you know, below target inflation, has the Fed going to sit on the sidelines for the rest of this year?
One of the gauges the Fed was following earlier, Ryan, I'd like to get your input on this. They thought that a declining unemployment rate would start to raise wages and the inflation specter. We're below 4%. That hasn't happened. What do you think's going on there?
Well, the slope of the Phillips curve, or the relationship between the unemployment rate and wages, or the unemployment rate and inflation, is flat as a pancake. And that means the unemployment rate could continue to drift lower, and the implications for inflation are pretty muted. By our calculations, the unemployment rate could fall another full percentage point, and that would only boost year-over-year growth in core inflation by about 10 to 15 basis points, which isn't a lot. So I do think, you know, the Fed, they haven't decided to divorce the Phillips curve, because for years and years and years, the Fed's been wedded to the idea of this Phillips curve. But I think it's becoming more and more evident that the Fed is putting less emphasis in that. And basically, they want to see proof in the pudding. And they want to see the unemployment rate continue to drift lower, to the point where if it does begin to translate into higher inflation, then, you know, the Fed would rethink its approach. But nationally, Phillips curves fly as a pancake. But when we look regionally and we use metro level data for the ECI and the unemployment rate, you do see evidence that the Phillips curve is alive in some parts of the country. Therefore, that suggests that, you know, this relationship could reinvert itself nationally, which would have significant implications for the Fed. But right now, I don't see that happening anytime soon. Therefore, the Fed's window to pause is wide open.
What, if anything, would cause inflation to rise? I mean, we do have oil prices close to $60 a barrel on the day you and I were speaking. Last year, that was a contributor earlier in the year. When we got up to, by October, we were up at almost $77. So outside, if wages isn't contributing to inflation and oil prices haven't, or at least they're rising now, we don't know how high they'll go. What would be a catalyst to kick in inflation?
So I think you have to look at the details of inflation. And I think the key thing to look at is core services prices. And those are generally influenced by domestic factors. So the unemployment rate, wage growth. In core service price growth, in those prices have been pretty firm recently. Where there's a lot of weakness is in core goods prices. And those are influenced by international factors. So the dollar, Chinese producer prices, and the strength of the global economy. It's unlikely. So basically, the path to higher inflation is going to go through core goods prices. And, you know, I don't think we're going to see any sudden turnaround in core goods prices this year. You know, they could, some pressures begin to build sometime in 2020, as the global economy, you know, finds its footing again. The dollar may lose a little bit of wind in its sails as, you know, the interest rate differentials across the globe become a little bit less glaring over the next couple of years. But again, I think all in all, inflation is likely going to remain right around the Fed's 2% objective for this year and into 2020.
When you look at this, typically, Ryan, one of the things that we've seen in this economic recovery, growth tends to slow down in the first quarter, and then reaccelerates in the second and third. Do you think we'll see that happen again this year? In other words, we know, for example, last time I had you on the program, we were right in the middle of a government shutdown, probably one of the most extensive we've seen in a while. We know that is going to have some impact on first quarter GDP. What about going into the second and third quarter? What would be a catalyst to improve economic growth if that indeed does happen?
I think you're spot on. I mean, you know, there's very few guarantees. And during this expansion, it's pretty much death, taxes, and a very weak first quarter GDP number. This time around, it's going to be weak again. And there's a couple factors behind that, which should fade in subsequent quarters. So first quarter GDP, we're going to get a drag from the partial government shutdown. You know, the government was shut down for most of January. So that's going to shave, you know, almost half a percentage point off first quarter GDP. Tax refunds, which are very important for consumer spending in February and March, were delayed a little bit. And that's going to likely be a factor as well. And then there's also this residual seasonality issue where, you know, first quarter GDP just has a tendency to come in soft. The revival, I think there are conditions in place where, you know, we see the economy begin to perk up in the second quarter and into the second half of the year. Well, first, financial market conditions have eased since we went through that bout of turmoil late last year. Mortgage rates have dropped. Long-term interest rates have dropped. That should help provide a boost to the housing market, which has, you know, had a little bit of a rough patch recently. So we should see more single-family construction, more single-family sales, you know, as we head into the second quarter and the second half of this year. Also, I think, you know, really the outlook for the economy hinges on the labor market. And the labor market's doing well. My favorite indicator is initial jobless claims, and they're still very low. So it suggests that, you know, the past tightening financial market conditions, this abrupt slowing in the U.S. economy, hasn't really affected businesses' hiring plans yet. As long as businesses continue to hire, you know, and the job market remains tight, wage growth, you know, continues to accelerate, the consumer will be able to put the economy on her back, and, you know, we'll be fine. We'll get through this soft patch without it morphing into anything worse. The issue is, this isn't the first time we've had, you know, a little bit of a lull in economic activity during this expansion, but this time around, it just feels a little bit, we're a little bit more vulnerable because measures of business confidence have really dropped. You know, CEOs are betting on a recession soon. Our weekly business confidence survey is its lowest it's been in some time. But fortunately, right now, businesses are saying one thing but doing another. You know, they're still investing a little bit, but more importantly, they're hiring. And that's going to be really key, is that businesses continue to hire, and that will keep the labor market strong. And, you know, that will get us through this little soft patch.
I want to talk about another issue that is still weighing over the markets. We've had two, the trade wars, and then, of course, the Fed policy. Well, the Fed policy has been put on hold. Let's talk about the trade war. In a recent piece on your site, you talk about the trade war has done more damage to the global economy than contemplated. Let's talk about that, because we're seeing a slowdown in Europe. The ECB is extending its policies, a slowdown in Japan and Asia. So how much of this will have an impact here?
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, the global economy has slowed. I mean, there's two areas that are holding up reasonably well, the Middle East, and that's attributed to, you know, the recent gains in oil prices. In the U.S., I mean, the thing to keep in mind is that we're on a little bit of a sugar high. We were spoiled last year because of the fiscal stimulus that boosted GDP growth close to 3%. And we're selling down into, you know, a more sustainable pace. So we'll grow right around 2-2.5%. That's not the end of the world. I mean, that's still above the economy's potential growth rate, which we would put at 1.5-2%. So, you know, some slowing growth is, you know, just a reflection of the fading fiscal stimulus, but also it was engineered by the Fed by tightening monetary policy over the last couple of years. And 2% GDP growth, you know, is roughly where we've seen for most of this expansion. Now, that with the trade war, I think it's done more damage than, you know, a lot of people are giving it credit for. You know, we have a $20, $21 trillion economy, so many economists are assuming that, you know, just a little rift here and there wasn't going to cause a lot of economic damage, because exports and imports, you know, they're on a huge driver of economic activity in the U.S. But it's clearly affected sentiment, and you can see that in measures of CEO confidence, investor confidence, and business confidence. And I think that spillover effect is beginning to be more evident in on the investment side here in the U.S. Also, the trade war, it's made it more difficult for manufacturers to source materials. It's had an impact on the supply chain, and that's all disruptive. And, you know, that affects sentiment, it affects some economic activity. So I do think, you know, this trade war is continuing to, if this trade war intensifies, I think it's going to have an even larger impact on the economy this year.
I want to talk about, we're what, in the 10th year of this business recovery. It continues. It could be the longest economic recovery in history. And that got extended to somewhat by economic stimulus with the tax cuts. Then we had additional government spending. But Ryan, we know sooner or later, governments haven't repealed the business cycle. So we're getting long in the tooth. What are your take on the possibilities that sooner or later in the next 2 years, we could face a recession, especially if, let's say, the unemployment rate starts to climb?
You know, I think the recession concerns are a little premature right now. I think, you know, economists, financial markets, I think many are, you know, have a case of the economic yips. Many economists missed the last recession, so they don't want to miss two in a row, and they may be premature to call the downturn in the next cycle. You know, basically, when it boils down to it, a recession is caused by two things: either an imbalance developing somewhere in the economy, you know, primarily in asset prices, or the economy overheats. So the labor market tightens gets very tight, wage growth accelerates, that puts some upward pressure on inflation. The Fed panics and aggressively raises interest rates, and then financial market conditions tighten, and a recession follows. But neither of those conditions are in place now or appear imminent. And also, I think the Fed has learned from their past errors, and they're not going to be the ones that kill this expansion by over-tightening monetary policy. So I think, in fact, the recession odds for this year, you know, I'd probably put it 25%. But given that, you know, we have the Fed on hold, that should help boost growth in 2020 by a couple tenths of a percentage point. So I think it lowers the recession odds in 2020. So it's going to, in the next couple of years, there are going to be some soft patches. We're just going to feel more vulnerable. But it doesn't mean that a recession is imminent. You know, there's no reason this expansion can't go on for a few more years. We're going to need a lot of luck, but it's still possible.
Wow. If that was to happen for another couple of years, we'd have a 12-year expansion, probably the longest ever in history. Ryan, if there was to be trouble, for example, an unexpected financial shock, as we saw happen in 2007 and 2008, if there was to be a trouble spot that could change your view and forecast on things, where would you expect that to come from?
We're keeping a close eye on corporate debt, particularly leveraged loans. And this is one area that's getting a lot more of attention, you know, not only from us, but the Fed, the IMF, have all drawn attention to the rapid growth in the leveraged loans. Since financial market conditions tightened late last year, the leveraged loan market growth in that area has slowed significantly. Also, because it's garnering a ton of attention, that means that it's unlikely going to become a bigger problem, because regulators will eventually likely step in and issue guidance on leveraged loans. But still, generally, you know, corporations have been on, you know, this non-financial corporations have been on a little bit of a debt binge. And that could be problematic as interest rates could move higher over the next few years.
A final question. We're in the beginning of a presidential election cycle, and we all know that politicians all want to get reelected. So as we head into 2020, is it possible we could see more stimulus coming from, let's say, fiscal stimulus coming from the government that keeps this engine going, at least through the election cycle?
I don't think so. I think, you know, given that we have a divided Congress, you know, the most likely outcome is going to be gridlock. So I don't expect any significant economic policies. That doesn't mean that lawmakers can, you know, take an extended vacation. They need to raise the debt ceiling later this year. And, you know, nasty debt ceiling fight would be problematic for financial markets. It would be problematic for the economy as well. So hopefully they can raise it sooner rather than later and, you know, avoid this scenario where they take it down to the 11th hour and eventually raise the debt ceiling, because they're going to raise the debt ceiling, because I think, you know, policymakers know that it's economic and political suicide not to raise the debt ceiling. But again, you know, there are, I don't anticipate any additional rounds of fiscal stimulus. You know, one area where there could be some bipartisan support would be for infrastructure spending, which is becoming increasingly important. We need more infrastructure spending. But I don't think, given, you know, the dysfunction in D.C., that we're likely going to get that this year or heading into 2020. The other thing to keep in mind is that, you know, we are debating whether or not the cycle is coming to an end, which is, you know, a healthy debate. But also, we're not ready for the next recession. The Fed, you know, they have interest rates. They're going to have 250, maybe 300 basis points to cut interest rates. Fiscal policy will provide less of a boost to the economy during the next recession, because there's going to be this perception that the U.S. government is out of fiscal space. So the burden is really going to fall on the central bank, and, you know, their traditional lever for addressing recessions, the Fed funds rate, it will pack less of a punch this time around. Maybe we have 300 basis points to cut. Each in the last two cycles, they cut it by more than 500 basis points. So that means they're going to have to get creative, more quantitative easing, maybe consider adjusting their policy framework to do price level targeting, nominal GDP targeting, or even average inflation targeting. So the Fed's going to have to get really creative, because the burden is going to fall on their shoulders.
Yeah, I was just going to bring that up, because if eventually we do fall into a recession, maybe it's a year, 2 years from now, not knowing when that happens, you know, the Fed, last time they began with the Fed funds rate at 5% or more, And also, the government was able to come in with fiscal policy. Well, we just passed fiscal stimulus, $1.5 trillion. So what happens if we do get into recession? Could we see something like we did in 2009, where the Fed launched QE, brought interest rates down to zero, and then the Fed or the government had almost $1 trillion fiscal spending bill?
Well, I mean, the severity of the recession will really gauge the policy response. And, you know, the severities can be determined not on the length of the expansion or how hot the expansion was running heading into the recession. It's going to be on the catalyst. So right now, you know, it's very unclear what that catalyst will be for a recession, but our working assumption is that the next recession is just your garden variety downturn. So that would argue that the Fed gets back down to zero interest rates, launches QE, maybe uses some more aggressive forward guidance. And then it's unlikely that you're going to get $1 trillion fiscal stimulus. That was just went through in the Great Recession. Hopefully that's a once in a generation type downturn. And hopefully we don't need that stimulus again. But again, from a fiscal policy perspective, it's going to be crucial that any policy response from DC is crafted well, in that you get your biggest bang for your buck, because we're not going to have as much fiscal space as we have had in past downturns to address the recession. The other thing to bring up, I'm concerned about the rest of the world. The ECB, if the recession, global recession occurs next year, the ECB is still going to have negative interest rates. The Bank of Japan, you know, is buying anything that's not, you know, bolted to the floor. I'm not sure what the policy response in those developed in Japan, in the Eurozone, in the United Kingdom will be, given that interest rates there are still extremely low.
So given your outlook now, even though we're going to have a soft first quarter, you expect things to pick up a little, and there is at least a very little likelihood of a recession.
We do. We think, you know, the first quarter is going to be pretty ugly. But again, we've seen this before. And we do think growth will pick up through the rest of this year. So all in, 2019 GDP will be 2%, 2.5%. That's fine. 2019, as more of this fiscal stimulus impact begins to fade, we're going to see growth fall below potential. So we'll have GDP growth rise 1.5%, give or take in 2020. And that's, you know, at the low end of our estimates of the economy's potential growth rate. So that's when we're going to be more vulnerable then to any shocks of financial market conditions suddenly tighten. If the trade war intensifies, that's when our economy will be much more vulnerable to, you know, slipping into a recession. But odds of a recession probably for 2019, 25%. In 2020, you're probably 35%. So it's far from a slam dunk. And the other thing to keep in mind is that economists' track record in predicting recessions is pretty poor. But, you know, in the end, we always focus on the economy's fundamentals. And as we're having this discussion today, the economy's fundamentals look pretty good.
All right. Well, listen, Ryan, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, you guys do a great job. You cover not only macro indicators, just about every one of them here locally, but you also cover them internationally as well. So tell our listeners about your service.
You can find our economic research on economy.com, where we cover the global economy in real time, around the clock, and we cover 300 economic indicators, provide country outlooks, and updates on global monetary and fiscal policy.
All right. Well, listen, Ryan, as always, thanks for coming on the program. Have yourself a great weekend.
You too. Thanks for having me. Take care.
And coming up in Hour 2, The Big Picture, Jim Poplav and I discuss Fed Chairman Powell's press conference following this week's FOMC meeting. That's where he made a major pivot. We also discuss the possibility of a rate cut by the end of the year, as well as the scaling back and ending of quantitative tightening. We also talk about the slowdown in the U.S. economy, liquidity, and debt. And in the second half of The Big Picture, we'll look at the mixed signals coming from the stock and bond market. That's all coming up in Hour 2, The Big Picture.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.